guys, for leading us. Before we jump into the sermon series, I wanted to give you a quick update on Open Door 2017. As Taylor mentioned it before, we're doing this campaign to raise money for where we feel like God is leading us. And there's a few things we're doing. We'll put this on the screen. We're going to start a new church in 2017. And we're going to start a cooperative, and we're going to invest in our local presence. And we're trying to raise $100,000 to do that. And we don't do campaigns a lot. We don't do giving campaigns. In fact, this is only the second campaign like this that we've ever done in the life of our church. And I'm most excited about this one because the money we raise is primarily going outside of the walls of this church. We're going to use a little bit of this money to invest in the facilities and what's happening here, but most of it is going to go to benefit people and places and things that God is doing outside of this church and outside of our own community. And that's super, super exciting because I remember what it was like when we first started New Denver Church. And we started from scratch, literally no money and no people. Well, we had our three families, and that was it. So we started with three. That was our church, three families. And I remember talking to people who didn't live in Denver and casting this vision to them and saying, we feel like God is doing something here and we're starting a church. Would you consider investing in it? And how many people invested in it? In a church and in a community of faith that they were never going to be a part of and that they were never going to benefit from. And their investment and their gifts initially are what made this church and what you experience now possible today. And I remember it wasn't even so much the amount that people gave. I mean, there were some big amounts. I remember someone gave a $33,000 gift one time, and we were so excited about that. And then I remember I had a friend whose dad passed away, and him and his wife inherited a fair amount of money from that, and they just decided, we want to invest this in something useful. And so they said, we're going to give $800 a month to New Denver Church, which didn't even exist then, like it was just an idea. And they did that for like 4 years straight. And I remember how amazing that was. And then I remember I had a family friend. This is a woman who's friends with my parents. She lives in North Carolina. She's in her 80s now. And she heard about this new idea of a church that we're starting in Denver. And she said, I want to support this. And I don't have a lot. I want to give $50 a month to support New Denver Church. And so she would handwrite checks. And she would handwrite the address on the envelope and mail a check every single month. And sometimes she would include a little note saying, how you doing? And praying for you guys and hope it's going well. But she would literally handwrite and handmail these checks every single month. And that started in 2008. And this is what I got from her 2 days ago. She's still writing checks every single month to support our church. And that's amazing to think about because she's investing in something that she doesn't benefit from. She just wants to be a part of what God is doing. And that's really the heart behind Open Door 2017. So let me tell you where we're at. We have this goal of $100,000. And here's what we've raised so far. We've raised $18,420. So we've got a little, I don't know if you can see it very well. And that's a good start. We just started talking about this a few weeks ago. We're hoping by December 31st to raise $100,000. So I know a lot of you have thought about giving and you said, I just haven't really looked at my finances and figured out if I can or how much we can give. So we just encourage you over the next few weeks to consider doing that. There's a lot of information at opendoor2017.org. So take a look at that and hopefully we'll see where God leads us over the next few weeks. Now, let me shift gears a little bit. A week ago today, Dan Snyder, one of our pastors, and his wife, Britt, welcomed their first child into the world. And we have a picture of Sutton. This is Sutton Jude Snyder. And in order to introduce you to Sutton, instead of bringing her up here right now, or instead of even showing you this picture, what if I told you about her lineage? What if I said, I want to tell you about not just her parents and not just her grandparents, but her great-great-grandparents and her great-great-great-grandparents, and I started walking you through her family tree. And I told you about sort of Dan's side of the family. And then I told you about Britt's side of the family. And she actually comes from sort of a Mexican heritage, which is cool. And I started telling you some of the stories. of her ancestors way back when. What if that was the way I wanted to introduce you to Sutton Jude Snyder this morning? If I did that, then you would probably assume, well, there must be something important about her family tree, or there must be something important about these ancestors. There must be something about their lives or their stories that somehow speaks to who this little baby is or to who this little baby is going to become. And the reason I tell you that is because that's exactly how Matthew introduces us to Jesus. He tells us about Jesus before we get to the common Christmas stories. We're in the Christmas season, and we're used to reading the stories out of Matthew and Luke. And before we get to those stories about shepherds and wise men and a manger and Bethlehem and a star over the city, before we get to any of those stories, Matthew starts his history or his story of Jesus' life by giving us a family tree, by giving us Jesus's lineage, his genealogy. And right there in Matthew chapter 1, it's the very first chapter of his book, and it's the very first chapter of the entire New Testament, he gives us this long genealogy of where Jesus comes from. And we introduced this last week, and it's really important for a few reasons. It's one of those passages in Scripture that we often skip because it's just a bunch of names you maybe don't even recognize. But it's important because of where Matthew is going. It's as if he wants to introduce us to Jesus and say, let me tell you where he comes from, because this is going to give you a window into who he is and why he came and what he's going to be like. And one of the purposes Matthew has eventually in his book is to show us that Jesus is the long-awaited King of Israel, that Jesus is coming back to sit on the throne and be the king to lead and deliver the people of Israel. And so part of the reason he gives us this genealogy is because that was important in Israelite culture to show that Jesus actually comes. He's descended from the line of kings in the nation of Judah and Israel. So he has this royal heritage. And so he goes through all the male descendants in Matthew 1 to show us Jesus' line that traces back to David and Hezekiah and all these amazing kings in Israelite history. But what's so curious, and we pointed this out last week, is that Matthew includes five women in Jesus' family tree. And he doesn't need to include these women. They don't serve his purpose at all. They don't really speak into the story that we think he's telling, but he includes these five women. And what's most interesting is the kind of women that he includes. They're not the kind of women, and they don't have the kind of stories that you would necessarily be proud of or that you would think to include in a family tree that's trying to set up how great and amazing Jesus is going to be. And so we've been looking at these stories. Last week we looked at the first one. Her name was Tamar. And today I want to introduce you to the second woman included in this genealogy, and her name is Rahab. Now, if you're not a church person, you haven't read the Bible very much, or you're not super religious, or you're coming back to church, you might have never heard of Rahab, but I can tell you this is one of those cool stories in the Old Testament that just has all kinds of interesting things going on. Now, maybe you are a church person. Maybe you've read through the Bible. Maybe you remember like, oh yeah, Rahab, I think I kind of remember her story. No big deal. I've read this before. I can just take a little 20-minute nap for the rest of the service. I would say don't do that because that would really sadden my heart. And you would miss a great story because there's spies and there's intrigue and there's deception and there's violence and there's warfare. There's all kinds of amazing things in Rahab's story. So it starts with Abraham. You might remember Abraham. God makes a promise to him. Says you're going to be the father of a great nation, and from you, from your descendants, from your family tree, I'm going to build a nation that is eventually going to influence and impact and bless all the nations and all the families of the earth. And so Abraham has Isaac. Isaac has Jacob. Jacob has 12 sons. They become the 12 tribes of Israel, and they start to become a nation. But if you remember part of the story, they end up in slavery in Egypt. And then God raises up a deliverer. His name is Moses. And he leads the people out of slavery in Egypt. And they worship God as they do this. And their name for God is Yahweh. That's what they call God at that time. And they believe that God is mighty and he's powerful because he rained down all of these terrible plagues as judgment on Egypt and all the gods of Egypt. And then he saved them and he helped rescue them and helped them leave Egypt. And then he parted the Red Sea when they came to the Red Sea and they went through it. It was this miraculous thing. And then when the Egyptian armies were chasing behind them and about to destroy them, the sea came back together again and God destroyed the Egyptian armies. And so the people of Israel believed that Yahweh was the most powerful God and the one true God in all the earth. He was mightier than all the other gods. They wandered in the wilderness for a while. They had a few missteps there, but eventually they came to the promised land. And at that point, Moses had died and there was a new leader in Israel and his name was Joshua. And God, Yahweh, said to Joshua, "Be strong. Be courageous. I'm giving this land to you." Now, there's people living in it. They're the Canaanites, because the name of the land was Canaan. And the Israelite people knew that the Canaanites were wicked, and they believed they were immoral, and they did all sorts of horrible things, and they worshipped all sorts of other gods. And so Yahweh said to them, "I will give this land and its cities into your hands." Now, there are provisions. If people in Canaan surrender to me, and they turn to me, and they trust in me, and believe in me, then I'll let them live, and they can join you. But if they don't, if they're resistant, then you'll have to fight against them. But don't worry. Be strong. Be courageous. I will go before you, and I will fight for you. And so they make their way to the edge. They kind of come to the south, and they have a few battles in the east, and they cross the Jordan River, and they're standing at the edge of all the big cities of Canaan. And this is what it says in Joshua chapter 2. We'll put the verses on the screen. Verse 1, "Then Joshua, son of Nun, secretly sent 2 spies from Shittim. 'Go, look over the land,' he said, 'especially Jericho.' And so they went and entered the house of a prostitute named Rahab, and they stayed there. And the king of Jericho was told, 'Look, some of the Israelites have come here tonight to spy out the land.' And so the king of Jericho sent this message to Rahab, 'Bring out the men who came to you and entered your house, because they have come to spy out the whole land.'" So we pause there. Joshua sends these spies into the land, and he sends them into this city that becomes well known, the city of Jericho. And they're not necessarily doing military reconnaissance. They're just getting a feel for what the people are like there and if there's any people who might potentially be able to help them. And so they come into this city, and they come to what's described as the house of a prostitute named Rahab. Now, the Hebrew word for house here can be translated in a lot of different ways. It's an interesting word, and it's fairly broad. It can mean a brothel, which would make sense because she's described throughout the whole story as a prostitute. So this could be a brothel. It could mean an inn or a hostel. It could mean a tavern or a watering hole. It's essentially one of those places that probably serves all of those purposes. It's the first place that a weary traveler would come into when they come into the town of Jericho and they're hungry or they're thirsty and they need something to eat or drink, or they need a place to stay for the night, or they're looking for a woman or a prostitute. This is sort of like the saloon of the Wild West, you know, frontier town that serves all of those purposes at once. And we're told that Rahab is in charge of it. This woman, she must have been a strong woman. It's not a man. It's a woman named Rahab. She's a prostitute herself. That's how she's described throughout the story. But she is in charge of this establishment. And the spies come in, and we're told that the king of Jericho has heard the rumor that Israel is on the banks of the Jordan several miles away, and they're a huge group of people, and they're probably poised to attack, and they've probably sent spies into the city, and he knows if any spies come into the city, I better check Rahab's place first, because that's probably where they went. So he sends word to Rahab, "If you see these spies or if you hear anything, let me know about it." And look at what happens next. Verse 4. "But the woman," that's Rahab, "had taken the 2 men and hidden them. And she said, 'Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they had come from. And at dusk, when it was time to close the city gate, they left. I don't know which way they went. Go after them quickly. You may catch up with them.' But she had taken them up to the roof and hidden them under the stalks of flax she had laid out on the roof. And so the men set out in pursuit of the spies on the road that leads to the fords of the Jordan. And as soon as the pursuers had gone out, the gate was shut. So Rahab blatantly lies to the king. I mean, I've heard about these men, but I didn't know where they came from. I didn't know what they were doing. And in fact, they took off. They took off late this afternoon, right before we closed the city gates, because they close the city gates every night to just protect from any possible attacks. So right before we closed the city gates, they took off. And I think they went in this direction. And so if you send your soldiers out after them, you can probably still catch them. And so the king sends his soldiers out after them. They close the city gates that night, but we find out she's lying about the whole thing. She's been hiding the men. She takes the men up on her roof, and it's not a roof like that, like we would think of. It's a flat roof. It's actually more like the upper story of her house, and she hides the men up there. And then she goes and talks to them, and look at what she says. This goes on, verse 8. Before the spies lay down for the night, she went up on the roof, and she said to them, "I know that Yahweh has given you this land, and that a great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. We have heard how Yahweh dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to Sihon and Og, the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, whom you completely destroyed. When we heard of it, our hearts melted in fear, and everyone's courage failed because of you. For Yahweh, your God, is God in heaven above and on the earth below." Now, this is huge, because Rahab gives this little speech to the men, and she basically says, "We've heard about you. And we've heard about your God. I mean, we've heard the stories of what your God did when he delivered you from Egypt. We've heard the stories of what he did to the gods of Egypt and to the Pharaoh of Egypt. We've heard what he did to the armies of Egypt. We heard the stories of what he did to the people of the Amorites and the kings of the cities east of the Jordan. We've heard all of this." And I got to be honest, she says, and she says this a couple of different ways and a couple of different times. So she's really emphasizing it. I got to be honest, our hearts are melting in fear. Our courage has failed. And think about that. In essence, what she's saying is, we're a proud people. We have a lot of courage. We have a lot of pride in who we are, in our defenses, in our city, in its great walls, in our great armies, in our great king who leads us, in our great gods that we worship, the Canaanite gods. We're proud of those, and we have courage and confidence in those, or at least we had courage and confidence in those. But as we've heard the stories about your God, Yahweh, and what he's done, it's like all of our pride and all of our self-sufficiency and self-dependence and arrogance has just melted and failed, and it's gone away. And she even says, "I have come to the place where I know and I believe that Yahweh, your God, is the one true God. Your God is mightier than our gods. Your God is the God of all the heavens and the earth." Essentially, before we read on, she's saying this. We have these feelings of fear as we think about your God. So there's these emotions and these feelings we have, and we're starting to think, or at least I'm starting to think, that maybe your God is the right one and your God is more mighty than all these. So I feel something and I think something. But she doesn't stop there. She actually does something. Look at what happens next. Verse 12. "Now then, please," she's still talking to the two spies, "please swear to me by Yahweh that you will show kindness to my family because I have shown kindness to you. Give me a sure sign that you will spare the lives of my father and my mother, my brothers and my sisters, and all who belong to him, that you will save us from death." You see, Rahab doesn't just feel something and she doesn't just believe something. She does something. She shifts her allegiance to Yahweh. And she demonstrates it in action by saving and helping these spies and lying about them to the king. I mean, essentially, she is putting her life on the line. She is risking herself for these men and for their nation and for this God. And I love what she says. She says, I have shown kindness to you. And the word kindness, it's used twice there. The word kindness is a really important Hebrew word. It's this word chesed, and you kind of have to say chesed like that. It's this word chesed, and it means, it's broader than kindness. Sometimes it's translated kindness. Sometimes it's translated doing mercy or showing mercy or even showing love or faithfulness or loyalty. It's the kind of word that's used to describe the way God treats Israel. When he calls them his people and he enters into a covenant with them and he says, I will continue to show my mercy and my kindness and my love and my faithfulness to you, irregardless of who, what you do and how you act. It's this sort of, it's not just an ooey-gooey feeling. It's not like, I really like you and want to hang out with you. It's not that. It's, I'm going to do something to show love. It's the kind of love that two people pledge to one another when they get married. I mean, they don't stand on the altar and say, like, I have just, like, when I see stars when I look in your eyes and I am fallen in love with you. I mean, all of that is maybe true, but at the end of the day, what they're saying is, I'm committing myself to you. For the rest of my life, I'm commit in good times and in bad, in sickness and in health, for richer or for poorer, no matter what happens, I'm going to love you. And what's interesting is we find it on the lips of Rahab. She says, I have shown that kind of commitment to you to save your lives. I could hand you over to the king like that, but I haven't. And you haven't done anything to earn that. I'm not doing this because you deserve it. I'm just doing it because I believe something about you and about your God. And so I've shown that kind of kindness to you, and I'm asking you to show that kind of chesed, that kind of kindness and mercy and love back to me. And she puts her life and the life of her family on the line. And she says, when you come back, because I know you're going to come back, you're just scouting things out. When you come back and you destroy and conquer the city, I'm just putting my life in your hands. And I'm going to show you this kind of kindness, and I'm going to trust that your God, as a result, will save me and will save my family. Now think about that for a second. She is placing her faith and her life in the hands of these men and their nation and their God. And she's a Canaanite. I mean, she grew up all her life with Canaanite customs, living in Canaanite culture, celebrating Canaanite traditions with a Canaanite family, worshiping Canaanite gods. And here she is, putting her trust in a totally foreign God and saying, I'm just hoping that when you come back, you will save me. Now, this is the kind of salvation. We sometimes use the word salvation in sort of churchy Christian New Testament ways to talk about spiritual salvation. But for her, it was physical, real life. When you come back, the city's going to be destroyed. And so I'm trusting in you and in your God to physically rescue and save my family. Now, let me stop there before we read on. Have you ever had that kind of faith? Where you've been in a circumstance in your life, where you've been in a situation where things are somewhat dire, where your job is just tanking, or your career is tanking, or you've made some horrible decisions, and you're sort of at the bottom, or you're going through a health crisis, or whatever it is, you're in one of those situations where you don't just believe in God, you don't just have a feeling about God, but you're sort of placing your entire life in His hands. And you're saying, I'm letting go of control and management of all this. I'm just trusting you. And the only way I'm going to be saved, physically saved or rescued in this situation, is God, if you save me. That's what Rahab is doing. And look at how those spies respond to her in the next verse. Verse 14, our lives for your lives. The men assured her, "If you don't tell what we are doing, we will treat you kindly and faithfully when Yahweh gives us the land." You see, they get it. I mean, they understand. You're putting your life on the line, and you kind of have our lives in your hands. You could give us up any minute. And so you are entrusting your lives to us and to our God, and you're entrusting your life to our God. And when we come back, we promise, if you do that, because you do that, because you believe at that level, and you're putting your faith in us and in Yahweh, we will show you the kind of kindness and love and faithfulness and rescue and salvation that you need. Now, you can read the rest of the story when you get home, because eventually, here's what happens. I'll just summarize. Rahab helps the spies escape. She lowers them down out of this window. They come up with a sign. They say, when we come back to conquer and destroy the city, they come up with a sign, and she says, I'm going to hang this red rope or cord in my window. Apparently, you could have seen her window sort of from the outside of the walls or from the outer gates. I'm going to hang this red rope in my window. And they say, if you hang that and we see that, that'll be a sign. And whoever is in your house at that moment, whoever you can bring your whole family into the house where this red rope is hanging, we will make sure that you are spared. You are rescued. You are saved. And the spies escape. She sends them out away so that the soldiers from Canaan and Jericho aren't going to find them. They're able to make their way back to the Jordan River, back to Joshua's camp. Several days go by. Joshua's army amasses. They come into Jericho. And then there's this interesting story. Maybe you learned it in Sunday school, where they start circling the walls of Jericho for 7 days. And eventually the walls come crumbling down. And we can read that another time. But after all of that happens, after the city begins to be destroyed and conquered by Joshua and his armies, look at what happens. Chapter 6, verse 25. But Joshua spared Rahab. Rahab who? Rahab the prostitute. With her family and all who belonged to her, because she hid the men Joshua had sent as spies to Jericho. And she lives among the Israelites to this day. So Rahab and her family are saved. They're delivered. They're rescued because she simply believed in Yahweh? No, not necessarily. Because she had a feeling about Yahweh? Not necessarily. Because she had a feeling that her God wouldn't save her? Not necessarily. God saved her because she demonstrated her faith, because she lived it out, because she placed her life in their hands and in his hands, because she trusted her life with God. And God saves her as a result. And I love the end of that verse. It says, and she lives among the Israelites to this day. Isn't that cool, man? Apparently this story was written when she was still alive. It's like, hey, you can even, if you want to verify all this, just go talk to Rhea. She's here. She lives with us. She is part of the family now. She's not just Rahab the prostitute. She's not just Rahab the one who lives the sort of shady, immoral life that people question. She's not just Rahab the outsider, the Canaanite, the foreigner. She has been brought into, she has become part of God's family now. She's part of us. And 1,200 years later, Matthew, writing the story of Jesus, reminds us of her story. He doesn't need to. He's telling the genealogy. He's telling the family tree of Jesus. But he says, oh yeah, don't forget, Rahab. She's important. She's a big part of this story. She actually becomes part of the lineage of Jesus. Now, why does Matthew include her? Why is it so important? Why is it significant that he has her in Jesus' story? I want to give you a few reasons. I think first, Matthew wants all of us to know that Jesus' family tree includes people like Rahab. That Rahab is a prostitute. She's a Canaanite. She's a foreigner. She's an outsider. And you have to remember that by Jesus' day, when Jesus starts teaching in Israel, everybody was really proud if you were an Israelite. Everyone was proud if you were patriotic. If you flew the flag and you did all the things and you said all the right things and you were moral and you were upstanding and you were righteous, you could believe and be assured you are part of God's chosen and elect family. You were in because you were inside all the boundaries. And it's almost as if Jesus shows up and he challenges all of those boundaries, because who does he go to? He goes to the women and he goes to the prostitutes. And he goes to the people who are unclean. And he hangs out with the people who are begging on the side of the streets. And he talks to Gentiles. They're not even part of it. He talks to Gentiles. Right? And Jesus comes and he basically, remember, he says, I didn't come for the righteous. I mean, it's great that they're righteous and they're Israelites and they're doing all that. I mean, that's nice, but I didn't come for them. I came for the people who feel like they're unrighteous and their lives are falling apart and that they're on the outside and that they're the ones that are marginalized and they're the ones that aren't sure if they're part of the family. I came for them. And the cool thing is, you don't even need to go to all of those stories about Jesus to see that. You can see it right here in Jesus' family tree when he reminds us Rahab is part of this story. I think Matthew also includes Rahab in the story just to let us know and help us remember. You remember that promise made to Abraham? That by this family, by this nation, all the families and all the nations of the earth would be blessed. This is the initial fulfillment of that. Rahab is the first person from another family, another nation who worshiped foreign gods, who ends up turning to Yahweh and turning to Israel and putting her faith in them. And it's almost as if Matthew is reminding us that's the ultimate promise and the ultimate goal and the ultimate reason Jesus came. And don't forget, you start to see the fulfillment of that in the lineage of Jesus. And it all starts right here with Rahab. But I think probably the most important thing about Rahab's story, and maybe the reason that Matthew includes it the most, is this. It draws our attention to the fact that faith is lived out. Faith isn't just something you say or something you think or something you feel. Faith is something you live out. And Rahab's story reminds us that she puts her ultimate trust and faith in Yahweh. Her life is in his hands. And you get to the New Testament, and there's a couple of places in the New Testament where writers of books in the New Testament focus on this idea of what true, genuine, authentic faith look like. And in both instances, James chapter 2 and Hebrews chapter 11, guess who they talk about? Rahab. James and the writer of Hebrews mention Rahab and say, hey, Rahab, she had the most authentic, living, breathing, real faith, because she lived it out. In fact, James would say, faith, if you just sort of say it, I mean, we can sing the words on Sunday, and those are important words to say, that I believe in God the Father. It's important to say all those things. But if you just say it, but you don't actually live it out, you don't actually put your lives in his hands, well, then that's just empty faith. That's dead faith. That's not real faith. Who had real faith? Rahab. Rahab the prostitute, who put her life in Yahweh's hands and trusted him for her salvation. And so how does that challenge us today? Well, I think it challenges us first to ask, where are you being called to put your trust and faith in God right now in your life? In this Advent season, what are you waiting on? What are you hoping for? What are you expecting? Where are you needing God's rescue and salvation in your life right now? So much so that, like Rahab, you're saying, I'm just going to have to give it all to you and trust in you. And I don't have any other way, and I'm not going to trust in myself anymore. I need you to intervene in this situation, in this place in my life, in this part of my heart, because if you don't, like, it's not going to happen. I'm just going to have to trust in you to save me and rescue me here. It's like standing on the high dive and saying, I believe that water's going to catch me down there, and I kind of feel like it will, and I've seen it happen for other people. And so I know it would all work out if I jumped off, but I think I'm just going to head back down the ladder. That's like God saying, well, no. You got to jump. And you can believe it in your head, and you can even believe it in your heart, but until you jump and actually put your faith to the test and actually believe with your life, God's going to rescue me. God's going to save me. I don't see how. I don't know how. I don't know how all this is going to work out. I don't have his perspective. But that's what trust is. That's what faith is. I'm putting my faith in him. Where's God challenging you to do that? One other thing, last thing this story does is it reminds us of the kind of people that Jesus calls to himself and the kind of people that perhaps best respond to him. You see, when Jesus showed up, there were all kinds of religious people. There were all kinds of people who had everything in their lives in order, who had the pedigree, who had read the Bible, who went to church, who gave the money, who did all the right things, and by all outside measures had good reputations. But they had serious questions about Jesus. And if you go back to Rahab's day, you know who didn't turn to Yahweh? The king of Jericho didn't. In fact, none of the other kings of Canaan did. In fact, none of the educated people did. I mean, the one good example we have is Rahab, the prostitute. Someone who runs a brothel, a watering hole on the edge of town. And it's a reminder that when Jesus went and he started hanging out with the Rahabs and the Mary Magdalens and the beggars and the lepers, they loved him, and they experienced his grace, and they knew it, and they felt it. And so if you're here today, and you would say, I'm kind of like Rahab. I'm kind of one of the Mary Magdalenes. My life is a mess. I have made so many terrible decisions. I feel so unworthy sometimes. You just need to know Jesus has almost a special, unique love and acceptance and kindness and chesed for you. You couldn't be more welcomed into his family. I mean, his family is a family of misfits at heart. Rahab is the person who exemplifies that, and you couldn't be more welcome. And if you're here today and you've been a Christian for a long time and you're educated and you've read the Bible and you've been to Sunday school and you've got a pretty good reputation, this is almost a warning. Because sometimes we can think, well, I've got everything together, and we can miss the fact that the people who don't have everything together more often than not experience and know and understand God's grace better than any of the rest of us. And they place their faith and their trust in him because at the end of the day, they don't even know who else to turn to save them. They only know that Jesus can save them. So it comes back to the same question. Where are you trusting in Jesus to save you in your life today? May you, this Advent season, wait and anticipate and expect and trust and believe that he will save you. Let me pray. Father God, thank you for Rahab's story. Thank you that you didn't come to call the righteous, but the unrighteous. Thank you that you didn't come to save and help those who are already found, but those who are lost. Because we're all lost. We've all known that feeling and that experience in life. And all of us probably can sense places in our own lives right now where we feel a little bit lost. And so we need you. Help us to trust in you. Help us, even as we sing this song and as we close this service today, to ask the question, how can we surrender more of our lives over to you and trust that you're writing a bigger story of redemption than we could ever imagine? We pray all of this in your name. Amen.